Einen wunderschönen guten Morgen, Inside Moin, ich bin der Micha und heute habe ich wieder ein Interview für euch. Und zwar habe ich mit der guten Lilith Walter gesprochen. Sie hat im Frühjahr diesen Jahres, also schon ein paar Monate her, hat sie ein super interessantes Projekt rausgebracht und zwar Nightmare Kart. und das hat was mit Kart Racing zu tun, wie der Name schon vermuten lässt. Und ja, es hat aber auch wieder was mit Horror zu tun, wie ihr vermutlich schon gewusst hattet, als ihr auf diesen Link geklickt habt. Wenn es ein Beitrag von Michael ist, dann hat es meistens was mit Horrorspielen zu tun. Und das ist ganz cool, weil das ist eigentlich ein Projekt, das ist aus dem Bloodborne Demake entstanden. Lilith Walter hat vor einiger Zeit so eine PlayStation 1 Version sozusagen vom Bloodborne gemacht und diese Fassung hat sie dann auf itch.io getan und das hatte Fans sehr, sehr gut gefallen. Das hat so die Quintessenz von Bloodborne eingefangen und dann kamen die Rufe natürlich laut, hey, mach doch was Größeres draus. Das war quasi nur so eine kleine spielbare Demo, so eine Art Proof of Concept und sehr viele Leute haben dann quasi einem größeren Release entgegengewettert, aber aus Copyright-Gründen ging das aber natürlich nicht. Und irgendwann ging so dieses Meme rum. Ich glaube, Lilith hat dann irgendwann einen April-Scherz gepostet und gesagt, hey, wie wär's denn stattdessen mit einem Nightmare-Card, also mit einem Bloodborne-Card, mit einem Spiel, wo die Bloodborne-Charaktere quasi in einem Kart sitzen und gegeneinander rennen fahren, so wie man es von Mario Kart kennt. Und das war natürlich nur so ein Scherz. Dieser Scherz kam aber so gut an, dass die Resonanz so, die war so riesig, dass Lilith dann gesagt hat, wow, wir sind da einer heißen Sache auf der Spur. Ich hoffe, wir müssen da wirklich ein Spiel draus machen. Und das hat sie dann auch. Und kurz bevor sie es veröffentlicht hat, weil sie dann zwischendurch immer so Sachen gepostet in der Community und so, kam Sony dann und hat gesagt, ja, leider kann man das so nicht veröffentlichen. Und die haben aber dann nicht so einen ganz strikten Riegel vorgesetzt, sondern haben dann sich mit Lilith zusammengesetzt und gesagt, das und das und das müsste verändert werden und natürlich auch der Name. Und dann haben wir kein Problem mit der Veröffentlichung. Das darf natürlich dann schon angelehnt sein und man darf es schon irgendwie wiedererkennen. Aber man darf bestimmte Namen nicht zeigen oder bestimmte Designs nicht einbauen, damit da kein Copyright verletzt wird. Und dann musste Lilith das noch ein kleines bisschen anpassen und hat dann zusammen mit zwei, drei anderen Kolleginnen dann noch, ich glaube, ein halbes Jahr dran gearbeitet, um das dann zu diesem Release zu bringen, der dann letztendlich dann im Frühjahr rausgekommen ist. Und das ist Nightmare Kart und das ist ein kostenloses Spiel. Ihr könnt euch das jetzt auf Steam oder auf itch.io einfach runterladen. Das läuft auch auf fast allen PCs, weil, wie gesagt, PlayStation 1 Grafik und ist von der Hardware-Anforderung jetzt nicht besonders groß. Und es ist tatsächlich ein ziemlich gutes Spiel geworden. Es ist ein super lustiges Kartrennen mit so ein paar Battle Arenas auch mit drin. Sehr viel Humor, wenn man vor allen Dingen, wenn man Bloodborne kennt, aber auch so sehr, sehr lustig, weil es einfach sehr ulkig ist, durch diese düstere Landschaft zu fahren und dann läuft da so eine kirmesartige Karting-Musik im Hintergrund, die das Ganze so konterkariert, also sehr, sehr unterhaltsam, aber unspielerisch auch überraschend kompetent. Also wirklich ein Spiel, das auch wirklich Spaß machen kann. Und da wollte ich mehr drüber wissen. Also ich wollte wissen, wie ist es zu diesem Projekt gekommen? Was war die Designphilosophie dahinter? Ich wollte auch mehr über Lilith Walter selber erfahren, wie sie sich als Künstlerin sieht, wie ihre Arbeit generell aussieht und so weiter, was ihr Gedankengang dahinter war. Ja, und habe sie dann zu einem gefragt, ob sie Lust hat, bei einem Interview dabei zu sein, also ob sie Bock auf ein Gespräch hat. Und das ist das, was ihr jetzt in diesem Cast in voller Länge hört. Lilith und ich, wir steigen relativ flott auch ein, also wir haben auf die Introduction verzichtet, das ist jetzt quasi das, was ich für euch gegeben habe, jetzt seid ihr hoffentlich im Bilde und während ihr diesen Cast in Ruhe hört, könnt ihr vielleicht schon mal parallel auf Steam surfen und euch das Spiel runterladen und angucken, dann bekommt ihr auch die richtigen Bilder dazu. Ja, und außerdem ist es natürlich auch sehr passend zur Halloween-Zeit, oder? Also es ist zwar schon im Frühjahr rausgekommen, aber Nightmare Kart, das schreit ja geradezu nach Halloween-Content. Deswegen ist dieser Zeitpunkt der Veröffentlichung ja jetzt auch gerade richtig. Okay, dann wünsche ich euch viel Spaß bei dem Gespräch. Das ist selbstverständlich auf Englisch. Sie ist da gerade in New York, als wir gesprochen haben. Und aber das kennt ihr ja von meinen Interviews. Dann wünsche ich euch noch viel Freude damit und bis demnächst. So, Lilith, ist okay? Ist es...
Yeah, looks like it. Let me get my mic a little bit closer.
Yeah.
Seconds. My setup is a bit messed up right now. There we go.
You also got a lot of chaos in the background going on.
Oh, yeah. We got a big open workshop for everyone here. All right.
Oh, that's nice.
There we go. How's that?
That's good. Yeah.
perfect. Also, perfect.
Also nice background with the workshop in the background. That's real cool. looks like an art workshop or something. Are you doing art stuff in the workshop, or what is it for?
I do a lot of like pleather working, and primarily like my roommate does, but I also partake in some of that. And another one of my roommates is like a traditional artist. So got a lot of art people in here.
So traditional in the sense of sculpting or painting and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. So and this is basically in your apartment. So you have your own workshop in your apartment.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome. Which is also a very New York thing to do, right?
Yeah, not a lot of space here, so we do what we can.
Yeah, that's cool. That's interesting. But you are not, did you also something with traditional art in the past, or do you also have a connection to it?
I'm primarily a digital artist, I guess you would say.
Yeah.
But I did do a little bit of costuming when I was younger.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that kind of led to me like doing my pleather working. Nowadays, a lot of that transferred over, you know, like cosplay and stuff.
Oh, that's awesome. You know?
Yeah. Nothing like crazy. I wouldn't say I was ever even close to a like professional level, but it was still, you know, I still did it. It was still very fun, very validating, learned a lot.
Yeah. That's cool. But costumes are in general are one of your things, right? So looking at the social media accounts, I see a lot of photos of different outfits.
Yeah, so a lot of that has like transferred over to you know, what I do now on the side.
That's really cool. And you are really into the Gothic scene, right? So this is why Baby Bloodborne makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I latched onto that game pretty hard.
Yeah. That's super cool. So you're a digital artist. What do you think about digital artists? Just making games, or do you also do different stuff with digital art?
Primarily making games. I also do like very short animated shorts. Mm. It's primarily like character focused, like character art. Obviously I'm doing a lot of like low poly character art now, but you know, I've done more higher resolution stuff.
Yeah.
You know, before I jumped into head first into the low poly stuff.
Is there something about low poly that really fascinates you? I see there's a lot of people, myself included, really starting or rediscovering their love for low poly PS1 stars. I grew up with PS1, and to me, PS1 horror games, like the ones from Puppet Combo or something, they are more scary than most mainstream games, to be honest. And there's something about it. What is it for you?
Yeah, I really love, I mean, it's kind of like pixel art in a way. I really love how you have to tell more with less, I guess, you know, like everything you design, everything you create has to exist in a way that can only depict so many details. So you really have to use a lot of trickery, a lot of fakery to imply detail when there isn't any. And I always find that really fascinating, you know, like with pixel art, like eyes, like how to draw an eye in pixel art is very difficult because, you know, if you have a small sprite, your eye is like 2 pixels, 4 pixels, you know, like 2x2 pixels. And seeing how many people approach that in different ways is something that's really fascinating to me. And just shows you what each artist's priorities are. Does, you know, some artists really focus on, in this example, like depicting the eye color, while some others just do a simple like black pixel and that's it. And that's I just find that really interesting. It really brings out the priorities of each artist. And I think that also applies to low poly as well. You know, where are those, you know, where is that meager triangle budget focused on and where isn't it? Right. I think I have, I do a couple of like art styles, and the one for Nightmare Cart, the head, the face of those characters is like I don't know, like 12 triangles. But I have other characters that are like, you know, I don't have an exact number, but, you know, like 10 times that amount, because I really want to focus on doing expressive faces, where in Nightmare Cart, it's a little more ambiguous, because, you know, that's more creepy, you know, that's more scary. And, you know, a lot of the character is instead in the body language instead of the face itself.
Mm. Especially also when it comes to the coloring. This is something I really like about the Nightmare Cart characters, is that you also use colors in a very distinctive way. So your color palette is obviously limited because of the piece one style, but at the same time, you can always make out the most important details about one character. So, for example, like the masks, for example, or stuff like this, which is really cool.
Yeah, especially with Nightmare Cart, it's really good to focus on like contrast, high contrast, right? Mm. Like Raven's mask is bright white, instead of it being a more muted, like brownish, beigeish color, like the, you know, like the original that was inspired by, because that just stood out more. Same with the big, you know, the big round, like goggle looking eyes on that mask. You know, you kind of have to exaggerate features to compensate for the fact that everything's so low resolution.
Yeah. Did you find that the vehicles are kind of a challenge to do in low poly?
Yeah, a little bit. I had a lot of fun with them though. The vehicles were designed, I guess the idea with taking Bloodborne and turning it into a PS1 game, Bloodborne is kind of known for being extremely intricately detailed. You know, it's a PS4 game. It's got a lot of triangles, a lot of polygons. When I first came out, I was playing it. A lot of people were like, wow, this is extremely detailed.
Still is.
Yeah. Not just the triangles, but like the, not just the triangle count, the texture resolution, but also just the design itself. You know, the city is just, you know, the city of Yharnam, and everything is just, you know, columns everywhere and archways and stairs and doorways. Every five steps, there's so much stuff, and getting that shrunken down to a PS1 game was really difficult. But the carts were all original designs, so they were made with the low resolution in mind, and that made it actually a lot easier than if, you know, like a steampunk machinery, I guess there is some steampunk machinery in Bloodborne, like existed, but like, you know, if there was, you know, a race car in Bloodborne, making a PS1 version of that would have been more difficult than just designing one from scratch.
Yeah. So the DMake thing you did years ago on Bloodborne is super interesting, because I feel like that DMakes are really an exercise in reducing stuff. What is the most important essence of a piece of art to keep the soul? And so when you worked on Bloodborne, what was the soul for you? What was the most important thing to keep?
The most important thing to keep, I guess there's two answers to this. The first one was, no, I guess this is the main answer, is the interconnectedness of the world. I mean, of course it's split up with loading screens, but it's still all interconnected. It still all makes geographical sense. Not only is Yharnam a big sprawling city, it's also an actual place that you can actively explore one-to-one. And that means you can get realistically lost. There's no map. And, you know, because it's a big 3D space, it's constantly turning in on itself and going above and under, and you're going back through and going through it all sorts of ways. That was the most important part. That was one of the highest priorities when developing the code base for Bloodborne PSX, was creating a system that could string levels together in a way that would trick your brain to thinking that it's all laid out geographically, even though they're just, you know, segmented rooms in their own instances, right? When you enter a gate and it fades down, fades back up, and you're on the other side of the gate. The room behind that gate does not exist anymore. In fact, there was never a room behind that gate. You know, like, so that was the most important part. A very small thing was when you go into a loading screen, the camera stops in place and the character runs away from the camera while it fades out. To kind of like prep you for like the little bit of downtime in the black screen. It kind of felt like the character was leaving and then, you know, you were meeting up with them on the other side of the loading screen, kind of help with consistency between levels. Yeah. And all that was outside of the, you know, the character running around was like one of the first things I worked on. And that was really important.
I think a lot of people were super enthusiastic about how you captured the essence of Bloodborne, and I find it funny that now Nightmare Card is actually based on an April's food shock. So you were like, okay, here's a joke. Maybe we should do a card racing game out of it. So what did convince you to actually do a full proper game out of it? So did the idea grow on you?
Yeah, the idea did grow on me. It was mostly, I mean, I'm going to be honest, it was mostly like the reception. Everyone was like, this is super cool. I love this. It got more traffic than any of my Bloodborne PSX stuff. Crazy. And I was like, all right, I'll make a whole game out of this. But it wasn't, not even. I was like, I'm going to release this crappy little demo I made for the April Fool's Day joke. And, but I couldn't release it in its current state because it was like an E3 demo. Like it was like half fake, you know, like it was playable, but it was like not really something a player could play and get an experience out of. So, I wanted to like fix it up and make it a real game. And that just, you know, one thing led to another. 2 years later, we have the whole game. It's kind of just, you know, scope creep, you know, that just happens, you know, feature creep. There we go.
But the thing is that the response is amazing right now. And even before that, I think you felt it. I think it's just a theory. For me, it's the juxtaposition of these two totally contrasty things, right? You have this super dark, maybe one of the darkest Lovecraftian worlds you have ever with Bloodborne. And then you have card racing. And you start Nightmare Card. You will be greeted with super dark, gritty piece one visuals, and at the same time, the most fun music I've ever heard.
The contrast is the entire joke. There was a review.
Yeah,
I really wish I had the review on hand, but it ended with what? Yeah, it was Nightmare Kurt only has one joke, but it's a damn good one. And it's just the contrast. It's funny. It's hilarious. And it just gets me. Like, you know, there's only one way to deal with someone as curious as you. Race me, you know. It's great. It's funny. It's hilarious every time. And that was I guess that was always the joke with the original fake leak that spawned this whole thing. Was just like, you know, we want to make something as ridiculous as possible for Bloodborne. Cat in the background.
hey.
She always starts meowing as soon as I start talking. She needs to talk too.
It's a cat thing. My cats do the same. It's currently just too hot in my office. That's the only reason they're not here. But normally in winter, I start talking and they're like, oh, you're talking to me. And they're just sitting
on the
desk.
Right, and then they start talking back. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, that's amazing of our kids. But it's just too hot in the office right now because of summer and all the computers. But normally they would be sitting here and asking for attention. But the thing, it works so well. And it works for, I mean, the campaign is like 90 minutes something. It took me like
an hour and a half.
Yeah, it took me about 2 hours because the boss fights were sometimes a bit difficult. But then again, it holds up. So it's really, really, really damn good joke. And at the same time, it works as a game. So this is the game is, it plays like a card game. And normally when you do jokes and you're like, okay, here's a 10-minute joke, and then you get over it. But it feels like a lost PlayStation 1 game, I think, which is one of the highest compliments you can give.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate that.
It's really, really cool. And it's also because of the music. I saw that a composer did it. Maybe you can tell me a bit more about the music. How did it come?
Right. Yeah. The music was done by Evelyn Lark, who goes by the Noble Demon online. And they did, for the April Fool's joke, they made a song in 2 days. It was incredible. And it was just, here's all the Bloodborne like themes, like the jingles, right? Like it reduced into jingles with, Mario Kart 64 style instrumentation and flow. I'm not a music person, but I don't know. They just did an incredible job combining all that. And, as the scope of the project grew, they just kept on making more and more bangers, and they're all great every time. And that was really incredible. They made an incredible OST. I think, the game.
Yeah.
The game's biggest strength is that OST, in my opinion.
It works a lot. So it would be totally different. It looks kind of like Nightmare Creatures. This was the first thing that came to mind, like the Callisto game, Nightmare Creatures, the first one. And but it sounds like it sounds like Nintendo 64,
right?
Super Mario Kart 64 or something, or this the other kart races at the time. And it really has the exact same instrumentation. So the synthesizers in it, they really sound like these fake piano sounds and stuff like this. It's,
Evelyn actually tracked down a period specific synthesizer. It was called the SC-88, the Roland SC-88, I believe. I believe that's what it was called. I'm doing a quick Google search. Yeah, that. To be able to make it sound as authentic as possible. And that was, I did not ask for anything like that. They just tracked it down independently. And it was really cool.
It totally works. And I think it really brings a lot of the fun. Also, the sounds are amazing. You put in like the starting sound and the winning sound. There's this trio sound.
Yeah. They did all that. It's incredible.
They did all the really, really, they nailed the overall atmosphere of this. So, but going back to the PlayStation 1 fascination, so is there something that draws you to PlayStation 1 aesthetics in general? Is there some personal connection to it, or do you just like it?
Yeah, it's very like nostalgia. I mean, I'm not going to pretend that it isn't. I grew up with N64 primarily like in during that era. But then when I got a PS2, we went back I went back and started playing some PS1 games through the backwards compatibility, primarily Final Fantasy 7, 8, 9, were the big ones, Metal Gear Solid 1. Those were like the main four that I like was like super obsessed with when I was younger. And then of course, once the PS3, I think, came out with the like, you can like buy and play PS1 games via partial emulation. Yeah. I started really diving into it. Armored Core was another big one. I got into Armored Core and Armored Core 2 on the same PlayStation 2. And then I went back and got Armored Core 1 and played that. After the like PlayStation 3, online retro thing started. I started playing a bunch of other games. That was when I got into I can't list the name right now, but trust me when I say I got on a bunch of other PS1 games. Not a blank. Oh gosh, what was it called? Oh, it's gonna drive me crazy.
It's describe it to me. Maybe I can record the name.
I should know this. It's so embarrassing.
It's not embarrassing at all. I forgot names all the time. What's the game about?
It's, it's just like, it's got really good, it's noted for its like really good graphics. It's, I want to say, Square Enix published. It's kind of gotten a bit of a resurgence nowadays, but it was very niche when it came out. It's top down, mostly like in caves, grid based. You can attack different limbs.
I want to say
it starts with a V.
it's with a goth girl in the lead role. Kadolka?
No.
You can attack limbs. Not from FromSoftware, right?
Not Shadow Tower. I'll let you know if I.
Okay.
I don't want to get hung up on this.
But there's a lot of PS1 classics like this. I definitely can see that there's a huge collection of games to choose from. And even if you. And now the fan translations are starting to kick in, and you can play some of the older classics that were never translated into English. You really start to discover some of the more unique games right now, thanks to the translation scene, which is really, really cool and awesome, in my opinion. What do you think about the resurgence of the PlayStation 1 style kind of games? So do you like what's happening there in the indie scene?
Yeah, I absolutely do. It was inevitable, I would say. Just, you know, like how pixel art was, you know, very much, you know, came into popularity after a couple generations, you know, and now it's low poly's turn, right? All of the I think the phrase was, you know, all of the biggest criticisms of a piece of art will become its great, you know, the thing that's remembered about the most fondly as time goes on. It's just how nostalgia works. So, you know, the PS1 and the N64 were seen as like the graphics are fucking terrible and there's nothing, you know, there's nothing redeemable about it, and give it a few decades. And now it's, you know, wow, the vertex jitter, the melting textures, it's, makes me feel like a kid again, you know? You know, it'll happen to every generation, you know? I mean, we're already seeing the early stages of it happening to PS2.
Yeah.
You know, we are going to see it with PS3, you know, look at some old early gen PS3 games, you know, I'm already being like, oh, remember those, you know, like the original Demon's Souls with its, you know, like it's, low resolution and everything's kind of barren and dark, but it is an HD and that's really cool. Or like that. And, you know, the PS4 with its fake crappy reflections and like, all that stuff, you know, people will eventually give it a few decades. People will eventually look back on that fondly, you know, the PS3 with its bloom everywhere.
These,
you know, the yellow filter.
Yeah, the gray, yellow, brownish looking games. So in the vein of Gears of War or something, they all looked, they had this brown tint all over the place. Brown, piss yellow. this is how I remember these games. So sometimes you're like, oh, you know what? From time to time, to play a game like this really reminds you of the certain period. And I get it. It's like... give it like 20 years or something when people who grew up with these kind of games are old enough to I don't know, maybe create those games, they really start to get into this nostalgia thing. And you're right, when it comes to PS2, thinking of the games from Chiller's Art, you know, these two indie guys from Japan, they do indie horror games on Steam.
Say it again? Sorry,
Chiller's Art? Chiller's Art?
I don't think so. I don't think I've heard of them now.
Yeah, but they're going into the early PS2 style of games.
Yeah, so I've been awesome. Seeing a few of it. I've seen a few like PS2 style projects cropping up.
Yeah.
Really exciting.
It's really cool. Is there something extra creepy about PlayStation 1 graphics for you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Just like VHS or even pixel art, just trying to, you know, like we were just talking about filling in, you know, you have to imply detail when there's nothing there that really, really contributes to horror. I've had a lot of people, this wasn't intentional, at least at the start of development, but Bloodborne PSX, a lot of people said they found more scary than Bloodborne PS4 simply because there's a black distance fog, know, that just that can't render anything past X amount of feet, and that gun, you know, that freaks people out. even that by itself, you know, excluding the fact that everything is so low detail that your brain fills in the gaps, the fact that it just can't render things too far away and it has to dip down to black is just terrifying.
I recently talked to the devs of Crow Country.
Awesome, big fan.
Yeah, it's also, I'm a huge fan, and I wanted to talk to them. These are two brothers from the UK, and they were a little bit surprised, actually, of the very positive response they got from the game. So they were sure that people would like it, but not that to that extent. So they were super surprised by the success they had, and they also explained. I explained to them that one of the creepiest part about their game is the sound design, that they use these lo-fi sounds in the soundscape, like these lo-fi crow-like sounds, for example, in the background, and these lo-fi screams. And especially when it comes to sound, the visuals, of course, they contribute to that, but the sounds, they're so lo-fi, you have to imagine yourself, what actually is that, what I'm hearing right now, right? So is this a crow? Is this a monster? Is this maybe a mix of a crow or a monster? Is this somewhere in between? You're not really sure. And this uncertainty really totally helps and really gets your imagination going. And I guess it's the same with graphics, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, crunching down the sound was always really fun, sourcing sounds from like libraries or recording them myself on the rare occasion and just crunching the resolution down and, you know, messing with it to, you know, add reverb, you know, to just make it, just processing it like you would a regular sound, but at super low resolution or super low hertz rate, whatever you want to call it, was always super fun. Another thing is that, you know, obviously sound takes up a lot of space, and I actually, one of the big things I really focused on that you don't actively notice is I wanted the game's executable size to actually be small enough to fit on a CD, which is 600 megabytes, 300 megabytes. I think it depends on the CD, but that was really important to me. That informed everything. The one concession that we had to make was it's not an actual MIDI player. Those are, you know, the sounds, the music that Evelyn, you know, delivered was just a WAV file. We couldn't find a way to, or, you know, we didn't want to spend the resources to get a actual MIDI player with a sound font in, you know, Unreal Engine. That would have been the whole thing. That's a concession, but just, you know, like limiting the number of spoken voice acting lines because audio takes up so much space and crunching it all down and, you know, try my best to reuse multiple assets so we don't have to import a whole bunch of, you know, art that would balloon the size and, you know, cutscenes aren't video files. I mean, as much as I would have loved to have a crappy pre-rendered, you know, boot up video that would have... you know, that was out of the scope of the project.
That would be awesome. But also when it comes to MIDI, I think they just added the MIDI, the compatibility for MIDI in 5.4. It's really, really late. Yeah, in Metasounds,
They've had MIDI support, at least in terms of a plugin, for a while. The problem is baking in a sound font, because the sound font is, you know, usually stored somewhere else on the computer, not in the project file. It was a whole thing. Maybe they do now. I don't know. But at least back in Unreal Engine 4.25, it didn't support that.
In 5, it's integrated into Metasounds
now. That's good.
Which is really good. If you set up your own synthesizers in Metasounds, you can...
Right, yeah. So all of the plugins are like, oh, you can use this for your own synthesizer stuff, not like in a game, you know? Yeah. It seems to be focused somewhere else.
Yeah, now with Metasounds, you can create the synthesizers in-game. So amazing for dynamic sound design and stuff.
That's great.
Really cool. But it's so new that how it is with Unreal. It's not even documented properly. You have to watch.
with that.
Yeah, you have to watch a lot of video tutorials from guys who are really putting the time in, like from sound designers particularly. On Metasound. So you look into the documentation of Unreal, you're like, okay, there's nothing. Hey, it's an experimental feature. It's version 1 0.1 and let's try it out for us and maybe we write a documentation about it.
Reminds me of Paper 2D.
Yeah,
Paper 2D. I have so many indie devs. I'm just like, oh, you use Paper 2D. Like, you have my condolences.
yeah. That's the weird part. But this is interesting. A lot of people assume that it's PlayStation 1 graphics. That's easy to make. But the reality is, it's not easy to make in modern engines, right?
Yeah, you have to. Right, you have to like reintroduce the jank. Either authentically or not authentically, like, you know, Vertex lighting just doesn't exist in Unreal Engine. That's just not something that Unreal Engine does. So in Bloodborne PSX, it was faked with a material shader. And, you know, that was that. But something like Dithering, you know, that's a pretty authentic. That's just an algorithm that you can just plug in. So like that's a pretty authentic thing, and like the affine texture warping obviously isn't something that you can just flip on in Unreal Engine, so you have to do you just have to do a bunch of work to get all this stuff back in. I never even implemented the like lack of the depth buffer, so like, you know, polygons are like constantly fighting to be rendered and all that stuff. It's difficult. It is very difficult to get that authentic look. I mean, it depends on, you know, what engine you use. And there's a lot of, you know, now there's a lot of like plugins and resources and like marketplace assets that'll get you up to speed, which is always great. But it does take effort to properly, you know, turn back the clock, so to speak.
It's because these engines are designed in a way that they want to make everything look better, of course. It's the aim of Unreal, at least. And to get back this jank, it is the Z-buffer jank you described, it's super difficult to emulate, because how do you get to the point that there's an overlap between these different layers, and how to simulate that? It's super difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And also, and it's I think when I played Nightmare Card, it was super convincing to me, at least. It looked very PlayStation 1-ish. And
thank you.
I was super amazed by the cutscenes. These cutscenes, I laughed so loud because they had this certain, how to describe it, they have a certain style of camera movement that reminded me of some anime shows, maybe a bit. So, for example, when in the first boss fight, the motorcycle gets revealed and there's a zoom out from the face to the motorcycle. It's like this is something I would expect in an anime or something, but it works so well in this game.
I had a lot of fun with all those cutscenes. All those cutscenes are made right at the end, super rushed, you know, because of the rebrand, if we can get into that potentially. But yeah, it was fun. It was great, you know, like I felt like I was like manifesting like the Majora's Mask development mentality, where it's like, don't question it, we don't have time, just make whatever and put it in, and like don't question it, just put it in. And we don't even know what the end result is going to be. Are we going to finish it on time? We have to. So just put it in. And that was just so fun. And it just really let you just do whatever. Just come whatever's first thing that pops into your brain. You know, it's just like, how do we do this? How do we do that? You know, I had a lot of fun with the Nicholas cutscene where he's on the ladder. And he's like, just, you know, it's like, hanging on the ladder and like coming off the ladder and like reaching towards the camera, and he had a bird on his head, like just like all that, just top of the brain stuff, right? I needed to change the cage on his head because of the rebrands, and I was like, well, what's the first thing that comes to mind? A bird cage, perfect, because it looks kind of like a bird cage. So I put the rounded top and put the hook on the top. It looks like a bird cage, and I was like, okay. Well, now he needs a bird, so I put a bird in there to justify it, and that was the new design, and it was great, it was fun, and you know, we put little bird peeps, so I hit the bird little peeps in his cutscene, and then Evelyn saw that and put tweeting birds in the song that's associated, And nice. Like, that's just like, we didn't even think about it. You know, I made that new character design in like an hour, you know, like, and that's, it's just fun. It just feels so hands off. It feels so laid back and chill. Go ahead.
Yeah, but I think this really works in favor of the game, because it's so you feel like this is, it feels like a passion project, and the passion comes through because you were so spontaneous, and these jokes came in spontaneous. Like the mm-hmm. I love the reveals of the vehicles, like the transformation with the clock tower.
that was so fun.
Yeah, and it's really it catches you off guard if you watch it for the first time. And I think in my imagination, it was like, okay, maybe also the idea for this joke somehow got you off guard. Maybe you're like, okay, this is very spontaneous, and now it makes sense that you explained to me this way, that you worked in a really fast pace on this. But this is why these jokes feel kind of honest. If this is the right word, yeah.
Yeah, what if she drove a giant clock?
Yeah,
like it's, I don't know. It's just fun. I had a lot of fun coming up with everything like that with you know, and Wes and Evelyn and everyone else on the team. It was really fun. Just what if we did this? Sure, let's do it. Great, like it's fun.
Yeah, it's a really liberating work process. But since you already mentioned it, the rebranding stuff. What do you think about it afterwards? So you had to rebrand it because Sony contacted you, and. Do you think afterwards this was a good thing for the game? Oh, did it turn absolutely. Out better?
Yeah, the game is way better than the original. I mean, one, there was just... it was specifically the campaign was now comprehensive on its own. The original campaign, it is very similar, but the original campaign just had less... story, less cutscenes, because you were expected to know the story already of Bloodborne, so it kind of just like vaguely gestured towards the Bloodborne story, expecting you to, you know, fill in everything in between because you knew the story already. But here's a perfect example. There was a boss fight where you originally fought the three Shadows of Yharnam in a Capture the Flag match by yourself, not just like Bloodborne, but, you know, you fought three on one, three shadowy robed snake guys versus, you know, you by yourself, granted if you're playing offline. And the campaign level for Bloodborne Cart was just, it showed, you know, the static image with text. It was like, you have to defeat the Shadows of Yharnam if you want to proceed. And that was it. And then, you know, the match started. But... for the rebrand, I redesigned the character, so they have snake heads now, and they're voice acted by Tasha Ritter, so now they're voiced, and, you know, she did an incredible performance for the Matilda sisters, the snake ladies, and because of that, I needed a cutscene to introduce them now that they're new characters that you've seen for the first time, and that just... made it a more memorable level, just straight off the dome. It's just a more memorable level now that they're original characters that have to be introduced, and you have to, you know, and it makes an effort to endear them to you, right? And that's kind of all over the campaign. I have to reintroduce characters, and I have to make more effort to make you like them because they're original now. They're not just like, hey, remember Bloodborne? Like, yeah, more that. That just overall made the game a much more enjoyable experience, in my humble opinion.
Yeah.
And same with the music. Evelyn had to rebrand all the music, and some of those tracks were years old. And just, you know, by virtue of doing it a second time after more, you know, years more experience, in my opinion, I think the mixes sound fuller. They sound better. Regardless of whether the tune they're playing is slightly altered or not. Like, sure, you're missing the Bloodborne connection. And I know there are people who really like that and really miss that. But just from a structural standpoint, I do, from my untrained non-musician ears, I liked the new renditions more, the rebranded versions more. They just felt more full, you know, like a person who was more experienced than they were years ago would sound like. Yeah. And that was great.
Sounds to me like the when Sony approached you and were like, yeah, please rebrand it. It was kind of liberating for you. Like this was really the way, okay, this is the chance to give the project its own identity, its own soul. And I think to me, the Bloodborne influences, they are really just influences. They're really just inspiration, like from every artist. Every artist gets inspiration from somewhere. And this year, if you played Bloodborne, you can see where the inspiration is coming from, and that's okay. But I think it has its own identity. So you created something unique with this. And this is why I'm always wondering, because some people were, of course, a bit disappointed that this is not an official Bloodborne game.
Sure,
But at the same time, I think if you can rebrand it in your head. It's still the original idea, right? So, but I think this way, you had the freedom to do whatever, and you were able to put in your own identity, your own art into it. And this is something, to me at least, which feels like the better way after all. So there are some fan games in the past that got rebranded because of reasons like this. I remember a Resident Evil 2 fan game, for example, which got rebranded into its own thing. And after that, people were like, oh, hey, actually, it's way better not to be tied to this very specific brand.
Right.
Or to this, yeah, right? Because you can do your own stuff. And it's something different to have just the inspirations on. So I was wondering.
Yeah,
so you're quite happy right now. Yeah.
Yeah, I had a lot of ideas that I couldn't do because they weren't Bloodborne enough, right? And I can suddenly do those again. And that's that, or, you know, back when I was doing the rebrand, it was really exciting.
Yeah.
And the example I always pull is this is just like a small visual aesthetic, but I noticed there was zero or very limited number of like roses.
Yeah.
When I think of a rose, it felt very Bloodborne, right? But there are no roses in Bloodborne. And that's just like, oh, it'd be cool. It would be cool if I could have someone have a rose aesthetic, but I can't because it's Bloodborne. So one of the first things I did when we had the rebrand was give one of the characters a rose aesthetic, because I just thought that's such a fun thing. And you know, having, I don't know, it was just really fun. Just like small stuff like that. It was really fun just having free range, do whatever, literally whatever. It doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was really freeing.
It's weird. Why are there no roses in Bloodborne?
It feels like a natural fit, but they're just not there.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's one somewhere, you know, in some random corner, but like, you know, they're not really a focus. You'd think it would be, there would be one.
For me, especially this gothic aesthetic, this really fits roses. So also thinking about different games with this aesthetic, like Roof Rose, obviously.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Exactly. But which, okay, ties a little bit more into the steampunky thing, but it still has, I think rose is the perfect flower for this kind of environment. Weird.
Right. You even fight, you know, the final boss in a giant field of flowers, but like they're just white flowers. I don't really know what kind of flowers they are, but you know, you'd think they'd really lean into that, but.
Yeah,
it almost like once, I mean, I'm just applying, you know, I'm just like spitballing here, but it almost feels like, you know, that was like an active decision to not include roses for whatever reason. Who knows?
Maybe. But there's this one of the many mysteries surrounding that Bloodborne.
There is a lot of like decisions like that, where it feels like to like make it seem less, to make it less generic, it seems like they took some ideas and changed it to make their own, like the doctor's mask that, you know, the character Eileen, that's not a doctor's mask, that's just a bird mask that's carved out of wood, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Even though it's meant to evoke the doctor's mask thing, they changed it to give it its own identity, which I just find interesting. There's a lot of that all over the game. They're not called werewolves. They don't call them werewolves. They're called scourge beasts, but they're werewolves, you know? So
these are not werewolves, these are not vampires,
yeah,
these are not Lovecraftian monsters, and this is not cosmic horror.
Yeah, I mean, even the vampire thing, like it's very vampiric, but like I don't as far, I mean, it's been a sec, but you know, the game is all focused on obtaining blood and getting your enemy's blood, and you know, the blood will make you more powerful, but there are no vampires in that game.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I'm sure you could make an argument that some characters are, but you know, there's no like classic vampire with the teeth and they bite your, you know, they bite your neck. Like, it's just not there.
I'm not
saying it's a bad thing, but it's just interesting considering, you know, how this, you know, how Bloodborne was designed and how that,
you know, especially Bloodborne. I think Bloodborne is very unique in this way, but I think this is also a very From Software thing to do. So when you look at other From Software games, they also tend to take a certain twist on things you already know from other games, right? So they
and really... That's a really fun way to design games, but also, you know, while you're making a fan game, that can be a bit limiting. So just to circle it back to, you know, now we have our own thing. Now I can do all this fun stuff that I wanted to, but I couldn't before.
But that's really, really awesome. I'm really, really happy about this, that it turned out this way, because when I heard about the news that that Sony contacted you, I was like, hopefully you can turn it around.
Yeah, it was not a cease and desist. It was, I don't even know what you would call it. It's so unprecedented for a company to reach out and basically go like, you could still release it, just change all this stuff. I mean, I'm not super like, you know, I don't know of every fan game that's ever been made, but from what I've heard, I have not really seen that before. It's either the game gets a cease and desist and is canceled, or people will rebrand it preemptively. Yeah. But I've never heard of a company being like, you have to rebrand it.
It only happened once with Capcom with the Resident Evil 2 remake.
So that was after Capcom reached out.
Gotcha. I don't recall the name. I think the new game was called Daymare 1998 or something, and this was the Resident Evil 2 remake, and they did this game right before Capcom announced their own remake of Resident Evil 2, and they were like, hey guys, and they were super friendly. Capcom is cool in general, but they invited these guys to their headquarters in Japan, in Osaka.
I think I heard about this. I remember hearing that story. That sounds familiar.
And they're like, hey, look at, you can get an exclusive look at our game with NDA, of course, and so on. But then now you understand you cannot continue like this because we have our own project. And they just asked them to rebrand it certain things. Maybe they discussed some details and so on. And that's amazing. So they could still release their own game and even make a sequel out of it. There was also a sequel a few years later. And at the same time, Capcom could do their remake without... This is the way to go. But for example, Nintendo they don't discuss.
Yeah,
so not, you release a fan game and then it gets immediately shut down, and they're really, really, really different.
When I was kicking around ideas for DMX, one of the main ideas was Metroid 64, and I was like, I'm never doing that. That sounds so fun. I'm never touching anything related. Never, not one.
Yeah.
because of their precedent to just completely eviscerate anyone.
There was this
so much as breathes as in, you know, on their property.
Yeah, absolutely. I wouldn't recommend that. There was this very, very good, really amazing remake of, I think it was Metroid 2. It was called
AM2R.
It was awesome. It was really, really good, but Nintendo immediately pushed it down. I think it took them like 3 days or something to I mean, once it released into the internet, it will never go away, but at the same time, it's a shame that they don't acknowledge. They were different to Sega. So Sega is quite different when it comes to fan games. They're like, keep the Sonic games coming. Please give us weird Sonic games, please. And I wish that Nintendo would be a little bit more relaxed about this. But I think it's cool. It's cool that they're like, hey, you can still release the game and just change the things super related to Bloodborne. I think that's the way a big company should behave if they are. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, so what do you think about the response right now? So want to build something different in the future with this response, or do you What are your plans for the future? Just chilling out right now, or do you are you working on a different project?
Yeah. So I don't want to promise anything because who knows what'll happen right now. But the response for Nightmare Cart has been more than I ever would have dreamed. We're pushing 600,000 downloads and
600. What?
Yeah, it's insane. Like what the fudge?
What the? You can curse.
What the fuck?
What the fuck? Shut the fuck up.
That's a lot. That's just Steam and Itch.io. Yeah. So like what? So there's.
Yeah.
I think. So I'm proud of the work we did converting it from a fan game to a full indie game. But with it being a full indie game, there are more expectations compared to it just being some silly little fan game. The biggest one that we did not address was online multiplayer. I want to add that. I felt like I'm just not a network engineer. I've worked with a network engineer very briefly back when I was industry, but that's the extent of my experience, and I'm confident that I could figure it out or learn how to do it, but that felt like way too much. It felt like overkill for a fan game, right?
Yeah.
For like a joke fan game. So I just didn't do that, and when we got the letter from Sony, and we decided to rebrand this and get it out as fast as possible. In a handful of months, that just wasn't enough time to add in multiplayer. So
yeah,
I think the biggest thing I want to do is add multiplayer. That's going to be, it's not happening next week. I can tell you that much, but it will, it is something I want to do. Another thing is just once again, it's a full on indie game now. I do want to just add more content to it. There's only like 7 racetracks and like 8-9 arena tracks. So there's like 16 levels, but I just want more. I want more of everything. So I want to expand that with DLC, and I want to look into getting a console release. But I don't want, I want to stay independent. I don't want to get picked up by a publisher or anything. So that does complicate things. But I do want to stick with Nightmare Cart for a while. There's obviously, a lot of people like it, and I would love to add more. And, we live in a state where we can add more now with games. This is modeled after a PS1 game, but with the power of the internet, we can expand existing games through content that is downloadable. So I would like to do that. That's kind of what I want to do. Before I move on to my next game, I want to give this game the most effort I could. Make it realize it to be the best game it could be.
That's super nice. I think multiplayer was the thing that really got mentioned in the comments, like a feature request quite a lot. Which makes sense. It's a kart racing game, right?
Right. It's a multiplayer game. It needs online. It is no longer a fan game. It is an indie game that exists in 2024 that is multiplayer. It needs to have online. And there's nothing I could really do about that. With the context of the game's development, but I do want to add it. I'm gonna try my hardest, but I'm not gonna promise anything.
is there a way how people can support you to make this, because it's after all it's a free game and nobody paid a cent for it, and is there a way how people can support you so that you can invest the time
for the stuff? Right, so it is free on Steam. It is Pay What You Want on Itch.io.
Mm-hmm.
So, you can download it for free, but the Itch.io listing, you can pay however much you want for it. So that's really nice. There's also my Patreon, patreon.com/LWmedia. If you want to support me that way, that'll give you, like some exclusive behind the scenes peek on what I'm working on next. And those are the two main ways.
Yeah, that's incredible. But I think it this kind of sharing the game for free really helped to raise the awareness of the game. So everybody was like, "Wait, there's this weird weird, nightmarish kart racing game. I've got to try this out. I want to try it for myself. And I think this really worked in favor, but implementing multiplayer is kind of hard. It's really time consuming. This is why...
Right. Really time consuming and really difficult to add.
Yeah.
After the game's been made, it's very difficult. That's what I, you know, when I mentioned back when I was in industry, I worked with someone, an actual network engineer, to add multiplayer to a game that was almost done. That was really difficult, as opposed to making it from the ground up at the start with online in mind. That's a lot more easy. Nightmare Kart is already out, so that is probably going to be even more difficult. But I'm going to try my best, and we'll see.
Super cool. Yeah, nice. I will put all the stuff into the description, so hopefully people click on it, try out the game, and maybe hopefully decide to maybe spend a few extra bucks on itch.io. I think this is the best. This is really one of the easiest way to go. And if you want to know more about the development, check out the Patreon, of course. What an amazing time to create games, right? It's so cool,
right,
that we have this. That everything is available to.
The barrier to entry is as low as it's ever been, and it's incredible. And it is great seeing people be inspired by, you know, work by me and other indie developers who like posting about their process, you know, being inspired to just download a game engine and, you know, download Blender and whatever, you know, for free, all these free assets and start free programs and start making stuff. And it's really exciting.
That's super exciting. We have to look back at the days when PlayStation 1 games were actually being made on a PlayStation 1 console. There was a high entry barrier. People had to buy development consoles, pay some fees to Sony, register as a developer, and need to learn all the programming stuff and so on. And now you can basically get by with basic programming skills. You can do all of the stuff in Blueprint, which is amazing.
Yeah, with the visual scripting, it makes it nice and easy.
It's amazing.
Especially for someone who's a visual learner like myself.
Yeah. And I think also that there's the possibility to have these super niche games that you can create a game for basically anything. So...
Mm-hmm.
Like a kart racing game mixed with Nightmare PS1 aesthetics or anything. So go on Steam. You can buy a game about grass growing. You can watch grass grow. And,
perfect. Yeah.
But if you're into it, you can have a game about it. You can have a game about several different topics and so on. This is what I really, really love about indie horror games in particular, is that all these the very small niche games really tap into very certain kinds of fears and phobias that you sometimes even had no idea that actually existed. So while a game like Resident Evil, for example, which costs lots of money and has also to recoup all the money, has to get all the earnings in later on, has to speak to a really vast audience, and they basically do the basic stuff like having monsters and lots of blood.
Mm-hmm.
There are indie games that can tap into a very certain niche and very certain phobia. And this is something I really like about these. And so somebody is like, okay, I want to create a game about, I don't know, fear of heights or something, or maybe fear of spiders, fear of, I don't know, fear of anything you want. And they basically just need 1,000 people or something to get the money back they invest in this kind of game. This is kind of awesome, I think.
Yeah, it's great. I love it. The indie scene especially is just exploding in ways that just makes me really happy. It makes me really hopeful for the future of video games. More than the AAA space ever has made me feel. So really looking forward to it. You know, I'm looking forward to making more, you know, weird indie games myself.
Yeah. Especially in the beginning, we talked about traditional art. So it's super, super hard to get something done in traditional art, especially in New York, where it's very competitive and so on. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about the indie scene? Do you feel it's super competitive, or do you also feel that there's always a chance to make something?
It's like you said, with indie game barrier to entry being so low to make an indie game, and just being able to cover any specific niche you want, Like, sure, there are more games that are coming out now than ever, I would assume, but
yeah,
also the number of people who are looking at those games is also, you know, way more than ever before as well. So, like, of course there's competition. There will always be competition in a system like this, but it really is, I don't know, you can, yeah, you can make a game about a very specific thing that, you know, only 1,000 people would ever be interested in, but
yeah,
you know, because barrier to entry is so low and, you know, cost, you can really get that cost down by not having to spend an insane amount of money on getting dev kits and stuff, that you can really recoup your costs really quickly.
Yeah,
I just find that super, super fun. You get a lot of weird stuff out there.
Yeah, that's really, really cool. Okay, one last question I have. Voice acting in in Nightmare Card is cool. Are these friends of yours, or are these who did the voices?
A bit of both. I'm friends with a lot of people who do voice acting work. So, you know, when the rebrands, you know, when I got the letter, I reached out to my friends and I was like, hey, you want to voice this guy? And they're like, yeah. But I also, you know, I didn't want it to just be my friends, because, you know, I did understand. I didn't think the game would ever sell more than 500,000, but I did, there was a lot of eyeballs in the game. So I didn't want it to just be my friends. So I did reach out in like the professional circuits, and get some people on board, to do some of the more prominent characters, you know, like, Kamran Nikad did Herman, and he did an incredible job. And, you know, Susie Hunter, who's been known for doing some voice work, did the doll. And yeah, a lot of fun stuff like that. You know, Gianni did the Father Gascoigne rebrand. But, you know, also, you know, I'm friends with Wes Wiggins, and she did, you know, Nicholas in the announcer voice, and some of the monster voices as well. That was really fun. And, yeah, I contributed a little bit when I just needed a voice. I did like some of the like high pitched monster voices. That was fun. Nice. So yeah, and like my roommate did like the mummy voice.
Yeah. That's nice. I like this. I like stuff like this. When also worked on an indie project and all my friends did the voices, and
it's fun. It's nice.
It's still super fun, and they were super bummed about super. They were super into it. They were like, hey, that's awesome. I'm actually voicing a game and stuff. And they were super interested in getting inside interest. And it sounded like a good mixture between voices I kind of recognize, like Susie, for example, and some voices that are quite unknown, but it kind of feels well acted in all cases. So this was really fun to hear.
It was really fun. Yeah. And, you know, we did like live calls, you know, and I helped with direction while they were doing the voice lines, and it was really fun. I love making cutscenes, and I love like voice. This is my first project where it's not fully voiced, but like all the cutscenes were voiced, you know. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of voice acting and like managing all that and calling people and, you know, coming up with scripts and all that. It was my first time doing it really and to this degree. And it was really fun. And it's kind of like making me reconsider doing voice work for other games. A lot of my, you know, a lot of my games don't have voice acting in them. Bloodborne was the exception because there were voice files to work with, you know, came with the game. And then with the rebrands, you know, I had to redub them because they couldn't just not have voices anymore by removing them. So that's what got me on, you know, to do this, and it was actually really fun. And it's making me reconsider, because my next, you know, my future games would also be a PS1 aesthetic, or maybe I'll push it to PS2 eventually. But I was never planning on having voice acting, because I thought that would have been too difficult for me. But, you know, I did it for a Nightmare Cart, and I did it really quickly with only a couple months. So maybe in the future, maybe I will do voice acting. Who knows? It was really fun though. That was a really fun experience.
Yeah. You can hear definitely that people had fun doing these voices. There's something, the energy comes across, which is really cool. Yeah.
Yeah, it was really fun working with voice actors and voice actresses, and them just being like, what if I just did this? And I was like, sure, yeah, whatever. You know, it's what, you know, do whatever you want to do as long as it, you know, like fits with the goals of the script. And I will, you know, I'll do my best to animate to match that energy. And that was, you know, that was especially with the, once again, with the snake, with the Shadows of Yharnam rebrands. Tash just did an incredible performance. That was almost done. The Shadows of Yharnam didn't talk, but the snake characters did. And that was kind of done last second. And, you know, I typed up a really quick script. And Tash just knocked it out of the park with like the crazy like witch like style, like cackling and you know, yelling at the player. And I was like, oh, this is perfect. So I'll just, you know, I'll do some like first person cutscene animation with multiple snake people talking to you. And it just all just worked out. It was great.
That's amazing.
Because the performance was so energetic and fun.
Yeah, the performances are great. This is why I wanted to ask, because that's the fun thing. You can feel there's so much energy going on into this project, like big and small contributions from different voice actors and stuff like this, and must have been a lot of work to put everything together, especially with the time frame. But at the same time, you can see that everybody had fun, and I think this is why a lot of people basically got the game. They got the joke. They got the joke. They got the game. They got the idea, and people feel enthusiastic about it because it's just fun. It's just fun. A lot of people, a lot of reviewers are just like, hey, this game is just fun. Some of them argue it's like it reminds them because of the classic gameplay. But I think it's fun because you can feel that people who created the game had a lot of fun. And this is something that really comes across. And I'm very happy. I'm very happy that it turned out this way.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Super cool. Yeah, Lilith, I think this was all of my questions, actually.
Perfect.
It was so cool to have an insight into the development and to get some what you thought about the process. And I'm really, really happy that you shared some details about the development. Super cool.
Of course. And thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. Thank you for basically taking this invitation and spending 1 hour with me. And thank you so much. I'm super happy. So you're in New York right now. I'm sitting here in Germany. For me, it's 10 in the evening. For you, it must be six hours back.
Yeah.
It's four in the afternoon. So yeah, we'll quickly stop the recording and say goodbye for the recording.
Awesome. Bye, recording.
Bye, recording.